very sort of philosophical, general introduction and motivation to ideas about background independence. Background independent quantum theories of gravity. Today I want to do a specific introduction to loop quantum gravity, and I'm going to do it in two different ways. So first, I'm going to present the basic structure of loop quantum gravity and a set of related theories. In other words, rather than going through, five lectures to derive what the quantum theory looks like, say from general relativity, I'm just going to go to the end and tell you what the structure of the quantum theory of space-time looks like. And I'm doing this for two reasons. One of them is because it's simple. It's much simpler than the path that you get there deriving it. And so you'll see where we're heading. And secondly, for philosophical reasons, because if something like quantum gravity is true, then the classical geometry of space-time is emergent and approximate, and the quantum description is more fundamental. And if the quantum description is more fundamental, then the question of going from the classical theory, so from classical general relativity, say, to some quantum theory, is a homework problem. It's an interesting problem of interest to know whether you can do it, but it's not of any fundamental significance. The fundamental question, that should have been QG for quantum gravity. The fundamental thing is to go backwards. Because if in nature the quantum theory is more fundamental than the classical theory, and that's certainly true for quantum gravity, then it doesn't matter whether a particular quantum gravity theory is derived from anything or not. What only matters is whether it's true about nature. And if it's true about nature, a feature that it will have is that you can go back from the quantum theory to the classical theory and derive the classical theory as a suitable approximation to it. Now, not surprisingly, that's the hardest problem in the system, although there is progress on that problem. So that's why I'm going to just tell you the answer first. And then, but I don't think that will take nearly all the time that we have. So then I'm going to give an introduction to general relativity as a gauge theory. And I'm going to follow the treatment in this paper, quantum gravity with a positive cosmological constant, HEP TH0209079. And basically, we're going to do sections three, well, in the whole class, we're going to do two to six. And probably today, we'll do two and three. Okay. So I'm taking this paper as the substantial text. This first part is from the introduction to HEPTH0408048. Okay, so that's my plan. I will talk for, we should go between something like 2 and 3 hours today, but we will take a break in the middle. So as we have in the past year. So we're not going to go just 2.5 to 3 hours straight. Okay. And administrative details, and this will be typical of the class that people will hear from later. Administrative details we'll deal with just after the break. Okay. Any questions before we get started? Okay. So here's what the answer looks like, and this will be new to some people and not new to other people, for whom I apologize, but even the people for whom it's not new to, they find it interesting the way that it's formulated. Okay. So I'm going to describe a series of quantum space-time theories of increasing complexity. Okay, I'll talk about the B theories. So quantum gravity has to be a background independent theory, but that means that it certainly doesn't depend on there being a background metric, but one does fix some background structure, and people differ in what they fix in different treatments of quantum gravity. So this is, I'll stick to one, and then I'll tell you what the variations are after we've done that. So we're going to fix a spatial topology. And until I tell you otherwise, we're dealing with just an S3 topology. But one could have a torus, one could have R3, and of course one can have different dimensions. Although we'll see in a minute why 3 is a very interesting choice. Okay. So I have some 3-sphere, I'll call that spatial manifold sigma, and at the present time all I fixed is its topology. And consider a graph. Since we're starting from the beginning, a graph is a set of points with some of them put into pairs so that there are lines between them. So consider, and I'll call the graph gamma, and we're going to consider all graphs. So there's some set G, which is the set of this all graphs. And to be specific, at the moment, there's no label, so the nodes are unlabeled. There's no distinction given to the nodes. And it's just a list of which nodes are connected to which, period. Okay. And for people, and there's also no direction for the moment. So they're unoriented, undirected graphs. Okay? Everybody fine with what a graph is?
So you're putting GR aside. Just
oh, yes. Yes. Till part two. Till part two.
Yeah, and these graphs are as any definite numbers of nodes and names?
Finite. But indefinite numbers of nodes and links. Thanks. Okay. It will not be hard to extend that to count. I mean, obviously, it would be if it was infinite, it would be countably infinite. But I'll stick to finite for that. Make life simple. Yes?
And if your spatial topology is G manifold is a compact manifold, or
this manifold can be compact, non-compact, compact with boundaries, etc. All the possibilities have been investigated. Okay, I'm picking S3 because it's the simplest example. Okay, now given a graph, another example of a graph is just a circle. Say just one node and a circle. That's a graph. And given a graph, we can embed the graph in the manifold up to topology. Okay. So, for example, and I'm always terrible at this. Oh my God. For example, there's an embedding of that graph, which is just a circle with a point into the manifold. Like that happens to be called a trefoil knot. Okay? If I drew it correctly. Over, under, over. Okay. And so there is another thing, and I'll call it G in brackets, which is all embeddings of graphs in G into sigma up to topology. Okay, so there's that set of all embeddings of the graphs. Okay, so in that, this is distinct from that, say, which is a circle which is unknotted, just a loop which is unknotted. How does this board work? Okay. I'll come to here. Okay. So, by the way, this is a countable set. That is, all the graphs can be described by a certain set of matrices of zeros and ones. And there's a finite number of graphs up to a fixed number of nodes and links, and you get a countably infinite set by considering all graphs with finite numbers of nodes and links. And this is also a countable set. And let me point out something interesting, that even the images of the circle all by itself are a countably infinite set. That is, there are countably infinite ways of tying a knot in one loop.
Would that part correspond to Cantor's Zaloff null?
Yes. Yeah, countably infinite Zaloff null. Okay. So this is a bigger set than this by quite a bit. They're both countably infinite sets. Okay. And by the way, by embedding, it means without intersection. So if there, so if there happens to be an intersection, then that's an image of a different graph, for what it's worth. So when we do an embedding, there can be nodes and intersections in the graph, but in the embedding, we don't pick up any new ones. Whoops. I changed the knot there. Okay. Now, I'm going to define a Hilbert space, H of sigma. And it's a very, given this structure, it's a very simple Hilbert space. I define it by giving a basis. So I define it by giving an orthonormal basis, which are, and generally, we use the same letter, gamma, for the embeddings as for the graphs, but to be careful, I'll use twiddle in this lecture to indicate the embedding of the graph. The twiddle means the embedding of a graph. And as I said, given one graph, there are an infinite number of distinct embeddings. So an orthonormal basis is labeled by the distinct graph embeddings. And so a typical state is a sum over the distinct graph embeddings of some complex number, such that the sum over the distinct graph embeddings of A, of the amplitude to B in each one, is equal to 1. So that defines a Hilbert space. Right? It's the simplest thing that you can do, given a set of distinct objects, associate each one to a space is element of the Hilbert space. So the inner product of this Hilbert space is just two non-invariants are have zero inner product unless they're the same one.
The dimension is infinite.
It's an infinite dimension. It's a count of the infinite dimensional Hilbert space. Okay? Because this is a countable, that's why I took the trouble to tell you, this is a countable Hilbert basis. So this is actually a separable Hilbert space, which means that it has a countable basis.
So these are all the possible embeddings of all the possible graphs.
Yes. Okay. I'm going to define for you two observables in this Hilbert space. An observable called the volume. So this is the volume operator in this Hilbert space. And it's defined in such a way that it just counts the number of nodes. Actually, to be faithful to, this is not yet loop quantum gravity, it's a simplification of it. To be faithful of it, I'll be a little bit more specific. So V hat acting on one of these basis elements, so this is a diagonal basis. And there's a number, V gamma, and V gamma is L Planck cubed times the number of four higher than nodes. Okay. So these two states are distinct. They both have zero volume. Here's another state that has zero volume. Here's a state that has zero volume. There are a lot of states that have zero volume. That's a tetrahedron. Here's a state that has non-zero volume. These two tetrahedrons set together, which gives you some four bale of cups. Okay? Is the writing too large or small? Everybody see? I mean, at this rate, I'm going to cover a lot of blackboard. We have a lot of blackboards. Okay. So another operator is, notice that V is meaningful because I'm talking about the volume of the whole space. Now, I also want to talk about area. And to talk about area, I'm going to now change sigma. So sigma, let's say, now has a boundary. So let's take it as a three-dimensional disk. So the boundary of sigma is a two-sphere. So that's a different example. Okay. And now I could talk about the area of the boundary. Okay. Well, before I do that, I have to make a modification. Let me make a modification down here. So if sigma has a boundary, then, so it looks something like this, then we include the possibility that the graph can end, can have edges with end on the boundary. So now, graphs And I actually didn't specify up here that they were closed. Do I want to do that? No, I don't want to do that. But let me indicate here the graph can have edges n on the boundary. It actually follows from the definition, because that is an embedding of a graph on in the manifold with boundary. Okay. If the graph ends on the boundary, then the points where it ends are called punctures. Are the points where a graph ends on a boundary. Since Mohammed is here, I will mention that you can have more interesting cases. For example, you could have some edges of the graph that run in the boundary, but you still call the point where it meets the boundary a puncture. And so the area of the boundary is an operator, and it depends on the boundary. And its definition is acting on a state. It gives you an area eigenvalue. And A is L punct squared times the number of punctures. So a boundary has Planck area squared of area for every edge that hits the boundary. And if you think about these graphs, I'm going to later develop the exact correspondence to gauge theory, but if you think about these as quantized electric flux, then this is counting the flux through the boundary. And that turns out to be the area. That's so far, that's a quantum mechanical system. It's not very interesting yet for two reasons. One of them is I haven't given any observables that don't commute. And it follows from what I said that the area and the volume commute with each other. So that's pretty boring for quantum theory. So I haven't given you something that I've just given you. It's not a modern quantum theory yet, and I haven't given you dynamics.
But these are operators in the Hilbert space, they're not Hilbert space.
Sure, they're operators in the Hilbert space, and I define the Hilbert space. But there are other operators in that Hilbert space that don't, sure, that don't commute with them. And So I'm going to tell you a version of dynamics, and I'm going to describe dynamics in the path integral approach, first of all, but then I'll tell you there's a corresponding way to think about it in the Hamiltonian approach. Okay, so I have to tell you what is a history, and I have to tell you how to define the amplitude for a history. And to simplify, and I might have done this all along, let me tell you, well, I'll simplify in a second and then I'll tell you the general rule. So the idea is that the graphs can change. That would be dynamics, the changes in the graphs. And when I was talking about things that were relational and so forth, you know, if you have now a discussion about time being relational, then these graphs describe networks of relationships. And a relational notion of time should be changed in those networks of relationships. But one thing that we want dynamics to be is local. We want local dynamics, and local dynamics, the only notion of locality that we have is given by the graphs themselves. Yeah?
I'm confused. I mean, until now it was fine, but now all of a sudden they're talking history, time,
yes.
Because we just started to see beautiful.
I'm just introducing it.
But where is it in the picture? Somewhere outside?
If you like, let's continue to think of the case with the boundary. So as to assuage your worries that I'm doing something really senseless, okay, and to avoid having to deal with the wave function of the universe in this lecture of the class, okay, let me assume that there's a boundary and we're talking about evolution as measured by a clock sitting outside the boundary. So we're now doing this case. I have some surface, okay, it's conventional quantum mechanics. We have measuring instruments that can be defined at the surface. Okay. For example, we could measure the area by measuring something at the surface, and we have a clock that we could measure things. Okay.
So, I mean, so far we really have, I mean, it's not yet a theory of quantum gravity, right? So why have we introduced something like a minimal volume and a minimal area? So in principle, this length field here is already extra, right?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm not trying to be, maybe I was unclear what I'm doing. I'm not trying to be axiomatic here. Okay? I'm showing you a structure. Okay, the real loop quantum gravity is a little more complicated than this in that the graphs have labels. Okay? And I will come back and introduce those labels. But I thought, but there is also a simpler structure when there are no labels. So I thought I'll introduce that first. Okay. And this is, and then there's going to be a statement at the end. I'm defining a class of theories, and there is a statement at the end that there is a quantization of general relativity, which is one of these theories. There's a quantization of supergravity, which is one of these theories, etc. Okay. But it's going to take us a long time to develop that statement. So
well,
I'm just telling you.
I'm perfectly fine with that. I was just wondering why we introduced at that stage something like a minimal length scale or whatsoever.
You can imagine that you're thinking about quantum gravity. Okay. And in fact, there are some specializations here which might be of interest. Okay, so let me give a specialization. Okay. Supposing I restrict to the four valence nodes. Okay. Actually, I'm going to do the dynamics and then I'll get to the special day. Okay, I will be thinking later on. So the dynamics consists of local loops. And you give the dynamics by giving a list of local moves and giving their amplitudes, since this is quantum mechanics. So local dynamics means local moves. Okay. And why I don't want to specialize this four valence yet is I want for a moment to talk to you about the dynamics specializing to three valence nodes only. Okay, because that's the simplest case. And once you see what the local moves are for three valence, you can see easily what they are for higher valence. So there are three local moves for three valence nodes. So think about the Feynman path integral the way that Feynman talked about it in words. You have an incoming state You have an outgoing state, and you want to give all the ways you could go from the incoming state to the outgoing state. The incoming state is some graph, is one of these graphs. The outgoing state is one of these graphs. Okay? And we want, and a history is going to be a way to go from an incoming graph to an outgoing graph. So, if I specialize to three-valent nodes, the things that can happen locally are the following. Locally means just involve a small number of nodes. So first, one node, one three-valent node, can become three three-valent nodes. Okay? And that's called the expansion move. So what it means when I draw this is I have some graph that this sits inside of, and I change that piece of the graph. So for example, I might have a tetrahedron. Yeah. One thing the subject does is tests your powers of drawing. And it goes to that figure. I just did an expansion move at this node. Okay. If I can do an expansion move, I can go backwards as well, and that's of course called contraction or an anti-expansion. Okay. So that's one kind of move.
So let me, these changes are happening within this three topology structure, and a clock outside.
I will make the things that I want to make about that when I get there. Okay? Okay. Yeah.
In these examples, you are moving on a piece of a graph. I mean, for the whole graph, does the graph have to be a closed graph? Or
doesn't have to be closed, no. It can have loose ends. You just have an end is like a one-valent node. Okay, so in general, there could be just an end that sits there, and it also can have nodes that end on the boundary. Okay, but I'm not ruling anything out, including that. Just an end there. Okay. So there are expansion and contraction moves. Okay. Now, it's not hard to show. And then maybe I can make this as a little, I'm not going to be giving formal exercises, but maybe I can make this a little exercise to think about if you happen to be bored or you happen to be bored sometime tomorrow, is to show that these are not ergodic. I'll define what ergodic means. So ergodic means you can go, a set of moves are ergodic if you can go from any input graph to any output graph in a finite number of moves. To any output graph in a finite number of moves. And it's not too hard to convince yourself that if you start somewhere, you can go to an infinite number of graphs by expansion and contraction moves, but you just go to a small fraction of the graphs that exist. I mean, for example, you know, just start with a triangle, but what can you do? You know, basically, you can just cut edges. And anything that you get is going to be some complicated thing, some complicated thing, some complicated thing, joined with three edges like that. Joined with a triangle. Okay. So you can make things with as many nodes and edges as you like, but you can't make anything starting from a triangle that doesn't fall into this class. So I actually did the homework. Okay. Now, there is another set of moves which are local, which look like this. I could have two nodes which are connected to each other. And again, remember that this is just a little piece of a graph. And I could switch the connections. In other words, let me label, this goes to something called A, this goes to something called B, this goes to something called D, C, this goes to something called D. I can just exchange what goes on in this little region. So I can exchange that, those two nodes, for those two nodes.
That's through a series of contractions and expansions.
No, you cannot do that through a series of expansions. Fine.
You could.
You cannot. That's an independent move. And these are called exchanges. Now, exchanges don't change the number of nodes. They just change who's connected to who. But notice it's also, it's local. It's the simplest thing that you can do. So it's still, it's slightly less local, but it's, you know, an expansion starts at one thing. A contraction starts with three things, which are all connected to each other. And a contraction is any two which are connected. So you can do it on any link.
Yes.
So A, I'm out of, so let me first notice, since I introduced the notion of ergodic, certainly by themselves the exchanges are not ergodic because they don't change the number of nodes, they keep the number of nodes fixed. This is the homework exercise. If I have both exchanges, expansions, and contractions, is it ergodic? And I'm not going to answer that. It's subtle. So if I have both exchanges and expansions, is it expansions and contractions? Is it ergodic? So I'll come back to four variables. Now we're doing three variables. So now I'm going to define a history, still three variables. So a history is a sequence of graphs, gamma 0 to gamma 1. Oh, these are all embedded graphs, etc., to gamma final. Okay. Each step of which is, so each move is one of these moves. So is, let me just say that these are all the local moves. So I don't have to keep listing them. Okay. So each move is a local move. So that's a history. The history is, for example, I start from there, then I go to there, then I so I can keep going for a while. Let's see, what shall we do? Shall we do an exchange here? So then, well, let me blow up this side again.
Does the history have to be causal?
I'll come to that in a second. So that's what I get from doing it the second time. Now I can do an exchange here. Let me just do it on the blackboard. If I do an exchange here, I bring this together with this. And I connect those like that. So I just did an exchange. And I can keep going, clearly. Okay. So that's a history.
So this exchange is take into account the topology, the embedding of the topology?
Yes.
Okay. So is there a different ways they can develop just one?
I'll tell you how it does it. Okay. It's actually an excellent question. What do I mean, okay, by that? Okay. So a way to think about what I mean by that is I bring them closer together in this way. So a way to think about it is I pull smoothly these together and these together till I have a four vertex. And then I split that the other way. And I can always do that because there's no accidental intersection.
And in a contraction, if I got somebody that's going through?
Oh, then I don't do it. I forgot to mention it. Thank you. You assume a contraction assumes that there's nothing left. Yes. Thank you. So contraction is literally the inverse of the extension. Okay. Good. Those are good questions. Okay. So that is a history. So I'll give that, I'll call such a thing an F. I'll call F for history, because a history is also called a poem. Because of Johnny Wheeler's ideas about space-time foam. So history is also called a foam. So a given history, you say, is a given foam. And now let me give, this was all kinematics. Given, you can easily see that given any two initial and final states, there are many histories that go from the initial state to the final state. So I'm going to do, to define a path integral, I have to assign amplitudes. So dynamics assigns to each kind of move an amplitude. So there is an amplitude for expansion, which is some complex number, an amplitude for contraction, and an amplitude for exchange. Therefore, there is therefore a history has an amplitude. So the amplitude of a history, which we call a foam, is the product of the moves of the amplitude for that move. Okay? So say the amplitude for an expansion move is I, and the amplitude for an exchange move is 2, then the amplitude for that history is minus 2. So that means two expansions and an exchange. Okay, so a theory gives these amplitudes. And then, this being quantum mechanics, the evolution amplitude.
I read the one about the non-Turing. Everything's perfect.
To go from some graph to some other graph, these are embeddings, is the sum of all the histories, of all the poems that go from gamma to gamma prime, times the amplitude for each history. And that's the definition of the pattern. You wouldn't believe you can actually get theories from that.
Sorry, what's the sigma, and then under you have F, and what's the subscript there? I missed that.
F.
Three.
Plural. That was my formal bad math notation. S. There's something over all the S.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. I mean, there's fancy ways to write all this stuff. You know, you can say that the boundary of a foam is the initial spin network minus the final spin network. There's lots of fancy things to do, but I just want to give you the idea. Okay? No time so far.
Okay. So the amplitude for a transformation which involves two at the same time is no. Right?
What do you mean by at the same time?
Well, in one step.
No, that's two moves. That's two moves. Now here comes an interesting statement. Okay, there is a notion of causal structure in this. Okay. Because if I make a move, then at a given graph, okay, there are moves that I can make which are independent of each other because they involve independent regions. Or there are moves that are not causally independent because the second move acts on a region which was modified by the first move. Okay? And so we can define that, and that's a very important concept. So I guess I'm going back to look for another blackboard here. Because I think I need everything. Okay. So consider two moves in P and Q. Okay. We say P is C to B, is to the future of Q. Okay. If P acts on a subgraph that is a piece of the graph altered by Q. Okay. So in my example, I made a move here and a move here. Let me call this P and R. And I should say, is there a notation for causally distinct? There must be. Like that? Okay. If not, okay, that's it. And this is called causal, and this is acausal. Okay, so here, P and Q are acausal. It doesn't matter, quote, in which order you make them. Okay. But then, when I acted here, let me call this R, then R, I'm sorry, I call that R, P, sorry, P and R are acausal, I call this move R, this move is Q, this move was P and R. They're acausal, so it doesn't matter what I did, what move I did them. Here, I affected the outcome of R. So the total causal structure is P, looks like P and R, which are acausal. And Q is to the future of R, but it's still acausal of P. Okay? So the moves are a partially ordered set. And in fact, they're a causal set. So that embedded in each spin foam history is a causal set in the sense of Rockwell, Sorkin, and collaborators. Okay. For those of you who don't know, a causal set is another approach to quantum gravity pioneered by Rockwell, Sorkin, Faye Dauker, and other people, in which the only structure is a causal set, a set of causal relations. Okay. Here, what you see is that a spin foam history has the side of the causal set, but the converse is certainly not true. This is a more, this has more structure than just a causal set. But that causal set plays a role, in an important role in the theory. Okay. There are other things that you can compute in this theory. For example, you can consider a one-word thing. So let me call this the evolution amplitude of gamma and gamma prime embeddings. So there also could be an evolution amplitude that cares about how many steps it took. And I'll call that T. It's an integer. And this is the same thing, the sum over histories F with T moves. You take gamma to gamma prime. Okay? And that's also an amplitude that's defined. If you. Okay. Yes?
Question, can those theories be those amplitudes be understood as some limit of the consistency formula?
It's
like, you know, your time steps are always one and so on.
A paper that has never been written is to say that this is an example of, is to apply the consistent histories formalism in some detailed way to this.
Okay.
Okay, I know, you know, I mean.
But then your amplitudes would need to be calculated differently.
Well, in the class of theories I just defined, all I told you is that the theory assigns these amplitudes. I haven't told you, because I'm just telling you the theory ab initio. Now, particular versions of the theory say some, you know, the which come with names of theories and names of people, okay, are alleged to come by a derivation, say, from, quote, quantizing general relativity or quantizing supergravity or quantizing a topological field theory. So there are many, many examples where there's a long, complicated derivation of what those amplitudes actually are. And we will get to that for people who are if people are interested in that. My own attitude is that it's good to know as a homework problem that you can start with general relativity and derive a particular form of these theories with very impressive looking formulas for these thing. The most studied one, for example, is called the Barrett Frame Model. And it was a great achievement, and it's a beautiful, beautiful piece of work. And does it have fundamental significance besides being an example? I'm not sure, because all that we should be interested in, I think, as physicists, is that there are choices of these such that from this path integral we can pull out physics that we know. For example, is there a semi-classical approximation to that path integral that pulls out the Einstein equations? Okay, and that's the important, I think, the important question. But a lot of work has gone into, and those two guys up there, the top learn, probably don't like the way I'm putting it, because quite a lot of work by a number of our good friends have gone into getting exact formulas for those amplitudes in different versions of quantizations of general relativity and other theories. And in fact, that's probably been the bulk of the work the last 10 years. And then studying questions related to them, like, does the sum converge? Can the sum be defined? Et cetera. Okay? So that is a class of theories. Okay. And I define a particular subset of theories, which were the three Bayley theories. Just for completeness, let me just mention how you would extend. I mean, it's So if there are more nodes, there are more moves. For example, we'll have, and now there are various choices, but for example, that's a local move, and it's a local move which preserves the topology because it comes from pulling together and pulling apart. But you might also make that local move, since these are quantum states, that they stand for quantum states, I can sum them, right? And you can give an amplitude for each one. So if I'm making an exchange move, I would make more local moves. And here, there are different versions of the theory where people differ as to what, say, the higher valence local moves are. And so for example, here's another thing that you might do with four valence vertices. Which is go from here to here. And actually, this one is the more commonly used one for a reason that I'll get to. So you have to specify what are the moves as well as what are the amplitudes. Okay. So once you get past three valence, there is some choice about what the local moves are. For example, you could do this, or you could do this. Okay. And different versions have different definitions. Let me tell you about the labels, and then we'll take a break. Okay? And I'm postponing for them for the moment. Let me stay with be there. But okay. So in the real version of quantum gravity, the graphs come with labels, and in the most studied version, the labels are spins. So let me just recall some facts about SU2. Spins are representations of SU2. They're labeled by the J, is 1/2, 1, 3/2, etc. And I left out the 0, 1 intentionally. The 0, 1 never appears in the subject the way that I understand it. Some laughter up there in the back. And it's interesting to ask a question, which is the following. So you can, there is an addition, representations of Lie algebras come with an algebraic structure, which is very important. And the algebraic structure is, first of all, you can add representations. So each of these, what I mean by this is Rj is a little finite dimensional vector space of dimension 2j plus 1. Is it some complex vector space? Okay. We can add them, Rj plus Rk. Okay. And there's also a multiplication. And actually, this is usually just written as J plus K, and this is the direct sum. And there's also a multiplication rule, J plus J times K. And an important fact about SU2 and other semi-simple Lie algebras is that the product of two representations as vector spaces is decomposable as a sum of irreducible representations. So this is a sum of some representations L of some particular representation, where L lives in a set, and we all know this, that goes from J plus K absolute value to J minus K. Correct me if I'm wrong. I often get little facts wrong, but I think that's right. Okay. Now, this, I'm going to say stuff that is, you know, from elementary quantum mechanics, but there are some things that will not be true for all the examples that we'll be interested in. So for Lie algebras, this is a commutative multiplication. But there are algebras for which it's not a commutative multiplication, and which we will be interested in. So I'll just mention that. Okay. Now, an important concept is when, if I have three of them, and I take J times K times L, an important question is the zero representation inside of that? So is the zero representation inside of J cross K times L? Another way to say that zero representation is like an invariant. Okay. And it's not hard to show. So when the answer is, when there is, it's a fact about SU2 that it's unique. So these are just facts about SU2. Okay. It's either yes or no. And when it's yes, it's unique. There's a unique invariant, we say, inside of the product of the three representations. And we have a little rule for when it's true, which is J as numbers plus K plus L has to be even, and they have to satisfy the triangle relations. Which is to make a triangle with J, K, and L in the plane. Okay? So that means, for example, that L is less than or equal to J plus K, and cyclic. Okay? Any questions about that? That's so those are facts you learn in quantum mechanics. There's actually deeper ways of looking at those facts that come from the theory of representations of the algebras and quantum groups and so forth, and later on we'll get to them. But for the moment, we just use those facts. And in the case, this very important, I want a word for this. So I want, in the case that J, K, and L have this property, but they have such an invariant inside of them, I want to call that a good triplet of representations. Okay? So now, let me define a spin network. This was first defined by Roger Penrose in about 62 in an effort to solve the four-color theorem. And so the spin network is a graph, gamma, and whose edges are labeled by representations, and whose nodes are all good. So that you satisfy the triangle inequality at each node. And you satisfy the condition that J plus K plus L has a given.
I'm sorry, you said whose edges are what?
And so I on each edge, I write a spin.
Spin, right, exactly. That's a spin label, right?
A spin label. And I make sure that I have a good triplet on each triple node. Okay. And to be specific, this is what's called a three-valent spin network, which is the kind that Penrose defined. Okay. So now a spin, we often reduce that to spin neck. A spin neck embedding, so I'm using the same notation. Gamma is an embedding. So this, for example, is a spin network 1, 1, 1, and it's an embedding into the manifold sigma, this spin network embedding. Okay. Now I go back to my Hilbert space, and I'm going to say the same words, but now these are spin network embeddings. So you have the normal space of spin network embeddings, and I'm doing SU2, I specialize in SU2, and I specialize with psi valence to define that Hilbert space.
Psi valence means that every node has three.
Yes, every node has three. Okay. Let me lift the restriction to psi valent Okay. Restriction to trivalent, and then this is the last thing that I'll define, and then I'll state some facts, and then we'll take a break. Okay. So consider a higher valence intersection, for example, one with four nodes. Okay. So then there are four representations, J, K, L, and M. Okay. Now, we want the same concept. We want invariants that live on the product of the representation. So we want an invariant on the representation J times K times L times M. That's the same thing as a map from J cross K cross L cross M to the zero representation. Now, what I'm hiding in this notation is what's really going on here. What's really going on is there are SU2 transformations acting in this 2J plus 1 times 2K plus 1 times 2L plus 1 times 2M plus 1 vector space. There are big matrices that represent SU2 transformations. And I'm looking for invariants under those transformations. As I'm looking for a subspace in that space which is invariant under SU2. Now, in the case of three valent, there was either one or there wasn't. What happens in the higher valent case when there are more than three is that there is a vector space of invariants. So there's actually, and we call that, because if I have one, if I have two such maps, I could add them together and I'll have another such map. So there's a vector space that this defines, a vector space which we call V, L, V, J, K, L, M. So it defines a vector space. In the space of three, the vector space is either one-dimensional or zero-dimensional, depending on those conditions. But here it could be some finite-dimensional. It's finite-dimensional because it lives inside of a finite-dimensional vector space. So it's finite-dimensional. It's a vector space of some dimension. Okay? So the rule is that attached to each node, there's a vector space in the space of invariance of the nodes, of the edges that come to it. And so a general spin network is a graph, and edges are labeled by some representation, and nodes are labeled by some state that lives inside the space of invariants. And that works for all higher valent ones. And we want, the condition that we want is we want there to be, this to be not trivial, so not a zero-dimensional. So there's still a condition you have to satisfy. But then, when you satisfy that condition, there's freedom to write, there's freedom to choose. So for the three-valent spin networks, you just have to label the edges by spins. For higher than three valent, you also have to put labels on the nodes. And it's a bit more complicated. Okay?
Sorry. But once you've decided the representations on the edges, isn't the invariant vector field given?
No. There can be more than one. Let me give you an example. You're probably not, we're doing such abstract sounding things. Let me look for a space to give you an example, okay?
Is the thing that labels the node the vector inside this inherent vector space?
Yes. Yes.
Not the vector space itself.
Yes. Yes, it's a vector inside of it. Okay. So one way to label it is to think in terms of channels, like a particle physics. So supposing this is 1, 1, 1, and 1. Okay. So what we're looking for is a map from 1 cross 1 cross 1 cross 1 to 0. Into 1 invariant. But that's the same thing as a map. You can just take dual spaces, and it's the same thing as a map from 1 cross 1 to 1 cross 1. That is, from here to here, and here's the map. And this map could be live in spin 0, it could live in spin 1, or it could live in spin 2. If you think about decomposing products of representations. So in the case of 1, 1, 1, 1, the 1, 1, 1, 1 is three-dimensional. There's three things that could be here. And these little trivalent diagrams provide a basis for the higher valent, the spaces of higher valent nodes. And all of this stuff we learned in quantum mechanics in that chapter on the addition of angular momentum, when you were worried about combining, orbital spin and spin of electrons, or when you were doing nuclear physics and you had a bunch of nuclei and you wanted to know what possible spin states a nuclei could be in, what classifying the random states it could be in. In the chapter of the quantum mechanics book where they dealt with that, that's what you were doing. Okay. Now, let me make a statement. Let me look for a blackboard and make a statement. Okay. So now I have defined H for some three manifold, and I consider the one for SU2, but for any valence spin networks. So a basis element in this Hilbert space is three structures. It's a graph. The graph is labeled by SU2 representations in this way. And the graph is embedded in the three-manifold up to topology. Okay, so there's three different structures going on. It has some complexity here. And the statement is that this Hilbert space is morally, and I'll tell you what I mean by that, is morally the Hilbert space of quantum general relativity in 3 plus 1 dimensions in the manifold sigma, fixing the topology of sigma. And what I mean by morally is that there is an infinitesimally more structure. Morally means you should replace topological embedding by piecewise diffeomorphic embedding. A little piece of structure that I don't think has anything to do with physics. But if you actually derive it from general relativity, then there's an additional piece of background structure, which is that sigma has a differential structure, has no metric, but has a differential structure, and the embedding is up to piecewise smooth diffeomorphisms. Okay. And then it's a theorem with this statement. Okay. And roughly speaking, this is the content of the theorem called the Lost theorem.
Sorry, what is being replaced by what?
So when you embedded the spin network in the manifold, I said embedded up the topology. Okay.
So the initial one you started.
Yes. Okay. So now sigma has a differential structure. Okay. And the graphs are embedded up to piecewise smooth if you want. That's extremely close to topology. And I don't know of any physical observable that can tell the difference between what I told you and what the theorem says. But since I'm an honest guy, I'm telling you what the theorem says. Okay. Lost stand is because it took a long time before it was published, but also stands for Lewandowski, Tiemann, and Hannah Salzman, and this is embarrassing. Oh, Ockel. Yes. Okay. And actually, the content of that theorem is uniqueness. That is that there is no other possibility. Okay. Yeah.
You were also going to make a statement about that one in previous one.
I think I will save that, but I should just, before we take a break, I should just fill in that where I talked about local moves. I intended to leave blackboards. Where I talked about amplitudes of local moves, okay, they now depend also on the labels. So the amplitude for, say, this move depends now on some labels JKL, JKL, MNO. Okay, so these are now functions of those labels. And similarly, in this case. And when I sum over all the histories, this also means that I sum over, right, explicitly all the labels internal in the diagram. So, roughly speaking, the set of moves, the initial structure I told you, are like Feynman diagrams, and the labels are like momentum. And the conditions on the nodes are like conditions for conservation of momentum and nodes, and the representations of like momentum. And that is, you can see. Okay, so, and that statement will also be made precise later. That is, there is a particular kind of theory, and I probably will get somebody here who knows this much better than me. There's a particular kind of matrix model called the group field theory, such that these histories are actually the Feynman diagrams of that matrix model. Okay. So any more questions? So I have to find a class of theories, a large class of theories, and you specify what theory it is. Just to summarize, by telling precisely what are the local moves that you allow in your theory, and what are precisely the amplitudes for those local moves as a function of the labels, and that gives a dynamical theory. And the two statements, one, this is a large class of theories. Two, within this class of theories is the quantization of general relativity, and within a, if you allow me to change from SU2 to some other algebra, then within this class of theories is also supergravity, general relativity, and supergravity in all known dimensions. Okay.
The meaning of the theorem, should we be able to understand it?
No, so what I now would like to do, we're going to take a break now, And when I come back from the break, I'm going to begin the work of going from one of those gravitational theories to the construction of one of these Hilbert spaces. And it will come with particular evolution amplitudes, particular observables, which become Hermitian operators in the Hilbert space, and so forth. And that's a long job. And I'm not going to do it rigorously, I'm going to do it heuristically. But it's still going to take us a couple of classes. What I'm going to do when we come back from the break is start the work of doing it for general relativity in 3+1 dimensions by telling you, without deriving it, I'm going to tell you what general relativity looks like as a gauge theory. And again, it's much simpler to state than to derive. And then to convince you that my statement is plausible, I'm going to describe the Sitter spacetime in these new variables. Okay. So why don't we take a 10-minute break? And for people who care, I'm sure like it's open. What?
What is open?
The next door.
Oh,
in case you want to get a glass of wine.
What?